This is an SBC Media Partners production.
Swung on, hit high and deep. Right field.
Could it be? Could it be? It is out of here.
Phillies fans, these are your club stories with Murph.
Let's check in with Greg Murphy. Murphy, you got a special guest, huh?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Glove Stories with Murph. Great to have you here with us. Brought to you by the great folks at Bet Parks Casino Sportsbook app, the Chi Vintage Sports, and Phillies Nation. Thank them for their support, and we are really excited about our guest today. Many of you know his best friend, maybe much better than you know the man himself, but we are welcoming in Tom Burgoyne, the best friend of the Philly fanatic. And you've been close to the big green guy, Tom, for almost, what,
yeah,
5 years at this point, I think?
It's been a little bit more than 5 years, Murph.
No, 35. You know, 35.
Yeah, 35. Yeah. It's crazy how time flies, Murph. We're having a ball. It's great.
Yeah, you get a chance to hang out with him every single day. And yeah, I know that relationship. Two of you is very close, but let's go back to the early days of Tom Burgoyne, St. Joe's Prep High School student, probably causing all kinds of havoc in school. Were you a rebel rouser in high school?
Rebel rouser. How about that? I haven't heard that term in a while, Merv. I usually throw out just class clown, you know,
okay,
class clown.
Right.
But yeah, little, you know, I used to have fun. I was the energetic kid. I was also the kid just lived and died Philly sports. You know, I just couldn't get enough of it. So that was my combination. You know, it's a little bit of class clown and just a diehard Philly sports fan.
Yeah, and then off to Drexel, so staying here in Philadelphia. You know, Philly, this city, for those of us that grew up here and stayed here and been lucky enough to have our careers here, it gets in your blood. It becomes part of what you are. And on the flip side, you and your best friend have become part of the fabric of Philadelphia as well. That's got to be pretty special, right?
Yeah, it's mind-blowing, Murph. I mean, if you would have told me, you know, when I was a 10-year-old kid that, you know, I'd be best friends with the fanatic all this time, it would just be it's just a dream come true, really, you know? So, you know, it's so cool when we have, you know, alumni days or guys passing through. It's like, man, we've gotten to know all these guys, all our heroes, the guys who we watched, you know, growing up as kids. So, you know, it's just been so much fun. I can't even describe it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm no different. I remember back in the day. Now, you met the fanatic in 1989. And at that point, he was hanging out with that guy, Dave Raymond. They were best of buds. But
they were the best friends.
But then in 1993, Dave had to go on his way. They're still tight. The Philly fanatic and Dave are still tight. But you became the closest friend of the fanatic at that point. But even for me, thinking back, you know, growing up and going to the vet in 1980 and 81 and 82, and thinking, I remember, you know, the fanatic doing his thing. The one bit I always remembered as a kid, like I was probably 13 or 14 years old, and this one resonates with kids like that. There was a pregnant woman sitting in the seat, and the fanatic went over and sat down. He pushed his belly up. I must have laughed for about a week after that because and those kinds of gags and pranks, he still pulls, right?
Still pulls, you know. I think that character, you know, Dave Raymond was, you know, the first guy, and you know, he really broke the mold, you know, and really you know, started things off. You know, people really hadn't seen a character like that before. I guess the San Diego Chicken, you know, was the first of its kind. Yeah, that's right, the Chicken. Yeah. But you know, so I guess that had been out there, but Dave was just so good at mime and slapstick and humor. Our sensibilities are very much the same. I still keep in touch with Dave. So I guess when I took over, you know, I was his backup for 5 years. You know, I think it was important to keep the character the same and some of those bits, you know. I mean, when the fanatic sees a bald head, he's not going to walk past that, you know. You know, that's just part of, you know, that's part of the fanatic's you know, personality. But so those kind of bits. And Murph, isn't it unbelievable, like you were saying, you're 14 years old and you remember that, you know? It's crazy. I remember the first time I encountered the fanatic, and I know exactly where I was behind the third base between the 200 level and the 300 level. There was that little walkway there, and he came out of one of the, you know, the vomitoriums there, and And there he is. And he laid a big smooch on my face. And I remember I went to spit it out first, you know, because I knew he was going to spit it out. I like, you know, I got him. But, you know, it's just, I guess that's the magic of the Fanatic. You know, you can, you know, have these, make a memory that lasts forever. And it's just, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I wonder, as you spend time with the Fanatic each and every night, if it ever for you feels like, oh, you know what, I've done this before. Because I can tell you from a fan standpoint and from someone who's been watching him for three decades, it never gets old for the fans. Does it ever get old for you as you observe the Fanatic?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And it's so cool to hear guys like you, you know, guys who've been in the business for so long, you know, sometimes the crotchetiest of, you know, writers, you know, some of the sports writers have come in town, these guys have been around forever. And when I hear them say that, you know, the Fanatic still makes them laugh and, you know, never gets old. And I think for me, it doesn't, I don't know, subconsciously, I mean, it's kind of the entertainment business. I always think of, you know, rock stars, Bruce, and, you know, they put it out there every night. And you know, when you go to a, you know, in the audience, there's somebody who's never been to a Phillies game before. And so, you know, just, I don't think of that, you know, it's not, I think just subconsciously, it's like, hey, the Fanatic's got to be on every night. And, you know, that's what he does. And that's his personality. So it's no big deal. But it is kind of cool to think that there might be somebody who's seeing the Fanatic for the first time, or maybe getting that first high five or smooch or whatever. So it's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll sit up in the booth and watch him do his thing and know exactly what's about to happen. Turn to one another and say, he's going to do this. He does it. And then we crack up because yeah. It's hysterical. Yeah. It's so much fun. All right. Well, let's go back to 1993. And at that point, you become best friends with the Fanatic, and that's the moment where you're spending the most time with him and starting, you know, as you said, bringing a lot of what was already there forward, but also putting your own stamp on it. And I would imagine those early days in 1993, you think about the season itself and everything that was happening, the group of guys that you're dealing with out there on the field. What was the overriding emotions for you as you kind of embarked on that, not even knowing that you'd be sitting here in 2022 still talking about it?
It was really an exciting time, Murph. I mean, first of all, the Phillies go to the World Series. The Bill Giles, you know, packs a charter plane with all the front office employees. We go up to Toronto, just the time of our lives, come back. I get married in November. Can't forget that one. I get married in November, go to Hawaii for, you know, 2 weeks, come back. It's now it's first week in December. And that's when Dave Raymond tells me, hey, I'm moving on. He's starting his own business. And that's when I know I got. So those 3 months, Murph, were pretty awesome. And then, the lead in was interesting, too. I remember the Daily News, you know, doing a whole thing like, you know, people were going to be on the spot, you know, in 1994. And, you know, the I was right in there, you know, like, can the new kid, you know, what can he do? So there was some of that pressure, but I felt really comfortable. You know, I'd been doing it for 5 years. I'd been watching Dave. I was working up in Fanavision for 3 years, working on, you know, the routines and the music played at the ballpark. So I had a pretty good feel for it. So that opening day, 1994, you know, that was the one. Remember, Crocker had his cancer.
Right.
And, you know, that was a lot of electricity at the vet that opening day. My family, of course, I think I had 50 of my, you know, family and friends sitting in a section. So it was really an exciting time.
Yeah. And you were off and running and haven't stopped since, and literally running at some points and doing your thing. There are so many great glove stories, as we like to say here on the podcast, that are connected with the Fanatic. And I want you to tell a couple, because you're a terrific storyteller, first and foremost. And a lot of folks haven't heard these stories. We're lucky enough to be around and hear some of these stories from time to time. But you mentioned Bruce Springsteen, right? You mentioned rock stars. And I know you've had your interactions with a handful of different, we'll stick with music first. I know there was a special moment, and I was there actually close to the front row in the Jimmy Buffett concert more than a couple of years back at this point. But tell that story about Jimmy Buffett, because that was a pretty special moment for you, was it not?
It was, you know, and and the in finale. Citizens Bank Park and Citizens Bank Park history too. He was the first concert.
Yes.
You know, we opened the ballpark in 2004, and then so it was the next year was the first concert, and they had asked. So Jimmy's crew had asked if the Fanatic could join Jimmy Buffett, and I'm a big Buffett fan, so I was thrilled. I remember doing a rehearsal at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I brought Video Dan with me. It's like, oh yeah, he's my he's my assistant. He has to be up here meeting Jimmy Buffett, but Jimmy couldn't have been nicer. But the only thing I was supposed to do was. The Fanatic was supposed to do was to during Cheeseburger in Paradise, they had a picture of a bun, lettuce, onion, and that part of the song when he rattles off the menu items and or whatever makes up a cheeseburger. And we were just supposed to run across the stage with these signs. And so it was cool. The Fanatic runs across. He's got some of his dancers, a couple of the crew running across stage. Well, the place goes crazy. And I don't know if Jimmy really understood the love of the Fanatic. Murph, yeah. Cheeseburger in Paradise, we run across stage. Well, the stage manager is like, go back out there. And so he does Fins, and he has the Fanatic to lead Fins to the left, Fins to the right. Murph, I mean, listen, it's great to do a Phillies game, 45,000 people. 40,000 people at a rock concert, everybody doing Fins is pretty cool too.
Yeah, and your perspective looking out, I've been I'm in the crowd doing my Fins, right? And that's pretty cool too, but I can't imagine what that perspective was looking out and seeing that.
Yeah, it was cool. And then I come off the stage, crowd's still going crazy. They send me back out there and he does a cover of Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl.
Yeah.
And so the Fanatic was out there for three songs, and I came off stage and they're like, you got to come back tomorrow night. So I did this. We did the same exact thing, the next night, and Buffett couldn't have been cooler. Like the last song, it was Glory Days. And I watched the whole concert from, backstage. Total rock star. He comes off. He has somebody like take the headsets off him. He's barefoot. He slips into his flip flops. And I said, thanks, Jimmy. Thanks, man. This is the greatest day of my life. And, he couldn't have been nicer. Yeah, it was great.
Wow, that's great to hear too, because I'm a huge fan of his. And there's so many more. I mean, we're talking about the biggest stars on the planet, right? You've had a chance to the Fanatic has had a chance to be up on stage with.
Yeah, when it started, it actually started the Vet. It was the first time Elton John and Billy Joel played together. Wow. And I didn't think of, I'm in a box and I'm watching the show, and somebody was with me. He's like, you should have the Fanatic, go down there and just show up. And it hadn't crossed my mind. I can't believe it. I felt like, I should have thought of that first, yeah. But the bug was in my ear. I'm like, let's get the Fanatic in there. So I remember going down. Have the Fanatic front row. Billy Joel is singing "The Bitch Is Back." It was the point of the concert when they were singing each other's songs.
Okay.
And Billy Joel looks down. He gets up from his piano. He grabs the microphone, and he's got the microphone in the Fanatic's snout, and he's singing into the snout.
So great.
So from that point on, every time I go to a concert, it's like, hey, maybe we could have the Fanatic jump on stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Murph, you did mention Bruce. That's when it didn't quite work out. Yeah,
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Bruce had done a concert series at the Wells Fargo Center, but one of the concerts got canceled because of weather. So he came back and did a one night only at the Spectrum in 1999 in September. And the Fanatic does his fifth inning routine. The Phillies are playing across the street at the Vet. And the Fanatic, after his fifth inning routine, is on his ATV. He goes right up the truck ramp and right across the street to the Spectrum.
Uninvited?
Uninvited. Of course, the security guards are there and, at the gates there. And they're like, hey, it's the Fanatic. Come on in, Fanatic. Like, there was no issue there. The Fanatic got into the Spectrum like that. And literally within a minute, Fanatic had gone down the steps over a couple speakers and was in the first row. And Fanatic's a big Bruce fan, Murph, and unfortunately, the song he was playing was Murder Incorporated, which is like a really heavy, deep, Bruce is in his own mind kind of, and he wasn't happy. He turned around, and from what we heard the next day, he was yelling at people to get him out of there. He wanted the Fanatic out. So somebody from the Spectrum came down and kind of escorted the Fanatic out. Of course, the Fanatic's high-fiving everybody, on the way out of the concert.
Oh my God. So,
but yeah. To this day, I always thought if he was playing Glory Days or one of these upbeat things, he probably would have brought the Fanatic right up, you know, like Courtney Cox, you know, but not to be.
You are not Courtney Cox. The Fanatic is not Courtney Cox. That's hysterical. That really is. I would imagine getting a chance to hang out with the Fanatic like you do, some of the experiences that you've had. I know you've traveled the world with him. Australia. Am I right when I say Australia, Japan? You've been to Japan?
Yeah, a number of times to Japan. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about those trips, because again, internationally now, the Fanatic is recognizable to so many people.
Yeah. And one of the ways that came about was back after I had just kind of taken over from Dave, Major League Baseball got very active with their international offices, and they have some offices all over the world. And they wanted to kind of have a fan fest type experience in some of these different countries. And they would bring the Fanatic along, which was great. I got a chance to travel to a lot of places, really, really neat. And then you have that Japan Major League Baseball All-Star Series that happens every other year. That is always weird to me, Murph, that more people don't know about that. You know, here in the States, it's been happening since the 50s. You know, players like Mickey Mantle and Hank Aaron, you know, used to go there every other year. So it's a really big deal in Japan. And Major League Baseball always brings their A-list stars. And so I got a chance to go on a few of those, which is great. You know, just hanging out with the big leaguers, they really roll out the red carpet for those guys when we're over there. But it does amaze me, you know, that people do really recognize the Fanatic, especially in Japan. They're such baseball fans. My only regret was I wanted to bring the hot dog launcher and fill it with sushi. And it was my one regret, Murph. I wanted to shoot raw fish at the Tokyo Dome.
Oh,
it never
would,
came
right?
to be. But I do remember that first time in the Tokyo Dome, you know, and I had an interpreter and my brother was with me, which was great. We had a ball in Japan. And but going into the crowd was very, very unusual. It's weird. You've seen Japanese baseball. The outfield is, they've got the bands playing and the people are making noise. The infield area, it's all very staid and very calm. And here comes the Fanatic into the crowd, which their mascots don't do. They have mascots. They stay on the field. After a home run, the mascot runs out and kind of high fives the player, and they throw a doll into the crowd. That's what they do. They don't go into the crowd. And I remember with the Fanatic, and they had security come and take the Fanatic out. And so we had to have a meeting and the interpreter, no, this is what the Fanatic does, you know. So yeah, it was neat. And the one highlight too, Murph, one of those All-Star Series, the Fanatic got a chance to dance with Sarahara Oh. He was the first base coach. And again, they had never seen this one before, in that the Fanatic put on a dress and made a beeline for, you know, the greatest home run hitter in, you know, Japan history. He was the first base coach, and I had cleared it ahead of time, but I forget what song, you know, and he gave a little bit of a danced a little bit, and the crowd loved it. You know, they loved it. So.
It's so great. I can picture that. And you know what? On a side note, I think it's probably important to mention that no matter where you go in the world, Australia, Japan, the other, I know you've been down to Mexico and Puerto Rico. Everywhere you go, I'm sure kids are wide-eyed and laughing. And it just goes to show you that, you know, we're all very similar, all around this globe, right? And that someone like the Philly Fanatic kind of points that out, that you know, we all share that love and need to laugh and be entertained, right? And he's able to do that.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that's what we have all in common. And it's neat because, you know, some of these places are more familiar with the Fanatic. Some of these countries that are, you know, you mentioned Mexico, that's, you know, the Fanatic has been, it's done the Mexican Winter League down there, like in central Mexico. And, you know, that, it you know, nobody speaks English, and the ballparks are small. And I always think of the Blues Brothers movie when the Blues Brothers went to play on that stage. Like, why is there chicken wire? It's like, well, because they're throwing stuff. And there's chicken wire in front of the dugout in the one ballpark we went to. And like, if they don't like the act, you know, you're gonna see it. But You know, but places like that, they all laugh at the same thing at the same time. They love, you know, Fnatic gets the umpire involved or whatever. It's pretty neat.
Bald heads need polishing all over the world.
We
know that. it's so cool for me to think about, you know, all the stuff that you've been able to do. But back here in Philadelphia, on a nightly basis, you know, and you're bringing it every night. It's not always perfect. I mean, there have been moments where the Fnatic has been in situations that, well, put them in a little bit of peril, right? I mean, are there moments where you thought to yourself, oh my goodness, the Fnatic might be in trouble here?
Well, let's see, in terms of doing some like stunts, like, yeah, you know, in terms of being in trouble and getting hurt, there have been some things we've done. I guess the craziest thing the Fnatic's done since I've been his friend is to rappel down from the top of the vet down to the dugout.
Right.
He did it three times. And it was a little, and we told the Fnatic, okay, hold on. First of all, you're going to be clocking about 35 miles an hour going down the wire, but also lift your legs, because if you don't lift your legs, you're gonna twirl. Well, the one time he didn't lift his legs and he came down, you know, doing one of these, and it was very death defying, but the Fnatic, well, he was a little freaked out by that one. That might have been the last time he did it.
Yeah, the Fnatic and his best friend might have said, "That's enough of that rappelling." For the, but that was at the vet. Is that what,
that was at the vet? Yeah, yeah.
Now think about how high that was.
Yeah. My brothers were up there actually. The first time I did it, my brothers came up because they knew what was, and so they were like, "Good luck, Tom." And as we pushed, and it wasn't me, of course. It was the Fnatic who we, you know, sent sailing. But
All right. Now, your buddy John Brazier told me another story about now often the Fnatic will catch the first pitch go down on the field and get his picture taken with the folks that are throwing them out. And from time to time, things don't always go the way you plan. Can you tell the story about the young girl that was a little reluctant to throw at first?
Murph, it was like one of the first games that I worked. Okay. So it was, we had opening day in 1994. This might've been like the next night game.
Wow.
And it was just funny because now they used to throw the ball out from the mayor's box, which was right next to the Phillies dugout. And they actually had to bring a band member, this little girl, she's probably about 12 years old, over to the mayor's box. She has her, you know, marching outfit on, and I think she was a clarinet player. And anyway, she throws the ball out, and here we go. And I took one right in the eye. Yeah, took it right in the eye.
and when the Fnatic takes one in the eye, I mean, he gets affected. Yeah. I mean, he's only human, right?
It staggered me a little bit. And I just felt like such a loser, you know, just like, you know, all I got to do is catch this, you know, this, and I'm fired up, you know, it's one of the first times. But when we talk about injuries, Murph, and I don't know if I've told you this one, and maybe the fans know it, but, you know, the Fnatic got hit in Lehigh Valley.
Oh, I remember. And,
Yeah. And, you know, he's three rows behind the dugout, and a foul ball hits the dugout and hits the Fnatic right in the neck, which amazingly somehow I wind up with the shiner, you know, that's how close we are, Murph.
Yes, but I know.
I'll never forget, you know, the Fnatic comes staggering, everybody's laughing because they think it's part of the act. And, you know, and so I get out to the aisle where the Fnatic goes out to the aisle, and the woman who's supposed to be taking care of the Fnatic, you know, learns that the Fnatic is hurt and they got to get him out of there. And so she goes on a walkie talkie and she calls the EMT. Well, we go up the steps, and the Fnatic, of course, there's 50 people waiting on the concourse, waiting for pictures. Meanwhile, the Fnatic is staggering. You know, he's not feeling great. Here come the EMT. It's like, oh, finally, and I'm, you know, going to get some help here. And the EMT guys pull out their cell phones and they want pictures with the Fnatic. You know, it's like, no, he needs to go to a hospital. You know,
yes. He doesn't care about your job. All right. Yeah, my job's over tonight. I remember that. I remember when that happened, when they put the nets up. That was one of the things I thought about. I'm like, all right, the Fnatic is safe now.
The Fnatic is safe.
On the dugout. All right, let me throw out a couple of names and tell me what you think about when you hear these names. Because again, in doing my research, your buddy helped me out. Bruce Bochy.
You have been talking to Brazier. It's his favorite thing. Well, you know, Dave Raymond, God bless him. You know, he did so many different things that were kind of revolutionary. You know, the four-wheeler, you know, the interacting with players, you know, that part of the game, you know, but before the game starts, it's kind of neat for the fanatic. Cause I think if you can win the crowd over in that first 20 minutes, you know, and you can, and you're goofing with these players who aren't used to being goofed with, you know, it's just something different, and it's great. And so he really started that. And so, you know, the fanatic, you know, it's continued to do that. And part of it is to kind of go through the lineups. And if you remember, Murph, you know, like back in the day, our guys really had stances that were very unique to them. So, you know, Schmitty had the butt wiggle. You had Pete Rose in the crouch. You had, you know, Gary Maddox with, you know, the long stride stretch. You had the bull just standing there. So players today, they don't, their stances aren't very unique. I think they're all taught now to do it a certain way, you know?
Yeah.
And so the fanatic has had to improvise a little bit with certain players and like just try to pick on some of either their name or whatever. But Bruce Bochy, you know, the manager of the Giants, I mean, he's got a huge head, big melon. Right.
Like everyone knows that.
Yeah. Everybody knows that. And he knows that.
Yes. Yes.
But so the fanatic would just do a whole mime thing, you know, where he pretends like pick up this big, huge, like boulder, you know, it's invisible. He's like carrying it. And then he puts it on his head, and then he can't keep straight. He's balancing, trying to stay balanced, and then he'd go down on his head, and then he'd try to lift his head up, and it's being weighed down, and he would do the whole thing. And the players would ask for it every game, you know, do the Bochy thing, do the Bochy thing. And Bochy would always be standing there right at the steps, you know, kind of smiling, you know.
Yeah. And good, easy, and good one. So but not everybody loves what the fanatic does, right?
No,
I mean, no. You've had your run-ins as well. I mean,
run-ins.
Yeah, famously, and I'm right when I say the Tommy Lasorda run-in was before you became his best friend, but you've had your own share of run-ins with those guys, right?
Absolutely, and with Lasorda, you know, and little known fact here, and Dave Raymond told me this, I did not know. He went to Japan once, and this is where he says it all started. There was a box of baseballs in the clubhouse that all the all-stars were supposed to sign, and they asked for the fanatic to sign the balls as well, and so he signed it on the sweet spot, and apparently that's where the manager is supposed to sign. And Tommy Lasorda was the manager at the time of that all-star team in Japan, so that's what Dave says. That's when it started, like, you know. And then of course Dave just, and the fanatic continued with the smashing of the helmets and the Lasorda dummy.
Yes.
And, you know, I couldn't, that was one of the things when I took over for Dave that I couldn't wait to, like, you know, pick up where Dave left off in terms of the feud. And I'll never forget that first game there in town. Tony, the old Italian security guard, of course, him and Tommy were like this.
Yeah.
And as the fanatic comes out, Tony has Lasorda out on the field, and Tony is going to make the peace. He's going to try to broker a little peace deal, like, hey, it's a new fanatic, let bygones be bygones. I didn't come close to it. I'm like, I don't want any parts of this, because I have a fifth inning routine that was going to totally tick Tommy off, and I didn't want any peace. This is great, you know, material, you know.
So great.
So we had a guy in Fanavision. We put him in the Lasorda jersey, and we put pillows, you know, we bulked him up, put pillows in his butt and white hair, and he comes waddling out. And I did, the fanatic did some kind of, you know, I forget how we abused him, but Lasorda, from just, you know, throwing baseballs and every curse word in the book, you know, just not a fan.
No, he never was.
Never was.
Never was. And then, no. You know what? Shame on him, because
exactly.
He should have found some humor in all of it. What about Phillies players? Give me one or two of the best guys that really, you know, kind of played into the shtick with the fanatic.
Yeah. And it's funny, Murph, because I generally will engage, or the fanatic will also engage the visiting team, you know, just try to knock them off their game a little bit, you know, maybe let the Phillies prepare for the game. So if you notice, the fanatic's not always going after Phillies folks, but the ones who do are usually the bullpen guys, you know, the guys who are just looking for something to do, you know. And I always think of Wayne Gomes. Wayne Gomes was a great guy, and he would always, you know, be up for dancing or, you know, having fun. So he's one guy sticks out. And of course, Shane was always kind of loose with the Fanatic too. He was always great. But again, you know, a lot of times it was, you know, let them kind of get ready for the game and, you know, and the Fanatic go bug the visiting players.
I've always felt like when a visiting player engages with the Fanatic and has some fun, steals the keys, yeah. You know, or does whatever. And that humanizes him to the point where Phillies fans are like, you know what, that guy's all right. I like that guy.
Would you agree with that?
They would think like that. I mean, from a marketing standpoint, it can help them in the long run, right?
Yeah. I mean, no question. And there definitely have been players like that. You know, we were just talking about Tommy Lasorda. Well, is it his godson, Mike Piazza, was always great with the Fanatic, and his routine would be usually once a homestand when they'd come in, the Mets would come in. The Fanatic has the ATV parked out there and would just go like this, and Piazza would come out and we would always do an arm wrestling bit. And of course the Fanatic would always get like flipped over and, you know, so yeah, he was one guy who always got it. And it does humanize a Murph, and it's cool for the fans to see the players having fun with the Fanatic. And I guess, you know, the number one guy now is Bryce Harper, always loved the Fanatic. When he was with Washington, would always be watching the Fanatic, enjoyed the Fanatic. I remember seeing him during the All-Star game. He made a point to come over to the Fanatic and, you know, you're the great, like, he would always do that. It's like, wow, Harper's cool. You know, the Fanatic always thought Harper was cool. And then when he got, you know, signed with the Phillies, we were down in Clearwater and they wanted to have the Fanatic part of, they didn't know this love affair existed already, but they wanted to have the Fanatic. You know, we had that press conference on the dugout, the roof of the dugout. And so we were being held in the locker room, the visiting locker room in Clearwater. Harp had his mom and dad and his wife and his agent, Scott Boris, and some other people. It was kind of like a holding area. Well, the Fanatic comes into the room and comes barreling in, and he sees Harper's wife and he goes to knock Harper over. He stumbles over a stool. Like, this is just before the press conference, because the Fanatic wants to give the big smooch to his wife. I can't believe the Fanatic just did that, but he laughed and, you know, was like, oh, whew, okay, thankfully. But then his dad, Harper's dad's like, hey, you know, Bryce, show him your bat. And he's like, yeah, Fanatic, check it out. And he shows me a picture of this beautiful art decorated bat that has the Fanatic all over it. And I'm like, wow, okay. And then from there on in, it was socks and shoes and, you know, total Fanatic fan, you know?
Yeah, and he is. I mean, he is. Yeah. You know, we're lucky enough to know Bryce a little bit, and it's not an act. I mean, he genuinely enjoys it. I mean, seriously, like 98% of the people on this planet genuinely enjoy the Fanatic, so it doesn't make him special, but he gets it, I think that's kind of cool. All right. We're running out of time. I don't want to keep you too much longer. But let me ask you this, because one of the things that I marvel at is the physicality of the Philly Fanatic. I mean, he doesn't look like an athlete, but man, oh man, some of the stuff that he does on a nightly basis, you know, it's a mix between the, you know, parkour and gymnastics. And, you know, I watched him walk on the back of the seats and I'm always like, oh my God, he's going to fall. The amount of energy and the on an August afternoon that the Fanatic expends out there on the field is enormous. How does he do it? I mean, how are you able to help him do that?
Well, you got to have a screw loose, Murph.
Well, that I know. Yeah,
that's,
you for a long
that's
time.
Number one. it's a little bit of a mirage too. It's almost like people, you know, the Fanatic dances, you know, and it's like, I always love it. Like, you know, sometimes I'll go to a wedding and sometimes I can kind of feel eyes on me a little bit. Like, I know people are like, oh yeah, that's, you know who that is. Okay. And like, when I go on the dance floor, I think people are expecting like Danny Terrio or something, you know, like they're expecting, and then they look and they're like, oh, like that can't be the Fanatic. Like, you know, so I think that the costume hides a lot of your flaws when it comes to that. And then, yeah, the physicality of it too. You know, and the energy, I think it's important too. The Fanatic takes breaks through the game. Like, you can't really keep that up for nine innings, you know, right. So it's, and the Fanatic has visits to make, and it's just, it's all kind of timed out to some degree, but the key is that, you know, if you've taken a break and you can get back out there and, you can lay it all out there and have that energy, you know, That's a big part of it. And yeah, the rest is just stupidity, Murphy. You
know? Well, perhaps some, but it sure is fun to watch. It's always fun to watch people doing stupid things, right? Before I let you go, I'll mention this just because you brought up the dancing. And you and I have talked about this before, but back in 1993, when you were becoming the best friend of the Fanatic, they were looking for another friend of the Fanatic to fill that second role that you had filled. And there was this young aspiring Fanatic friend right here that tried out and you talk did. About the dancing. Yeah, you can dance because the tryout, they brought us into the Eagles visiting locker room and they right. called my name. I'm 23 years old, just out of St. Joe's, and there's a table of panelists with a boom box in the middle of the table, and they yep. press the button and said dance, and I started, you know, like Dennis, I guess, or whatever. And and well, you know, those dreams were crushed just like that. So you must have
once we saw your dance moves, Murph, you were eliminated. You
know, I made it through the first couple of interviews, but then after the dance moves, it took me 20 years to get back to the organization. So, but I think it was for the best.
That can be the one that separates, the gang. You know, that dancing. You know,
yeah. I think that's where we definitely parted ways with me for sure. It's so great. All right. Final note, just the impact that the Philly Fanatic has. You know, we talked a little bit about it right at the top, but you have to be incredibly proud of the way that it has all unfolded. He is such a part of baseball. He is such a part of the city of Philadelphia. I know he's such a part of you as well. The pride that you have when you see the green everywhere you go. Can you describe that to us?
Yeah, it's hard to describe, Murph. And I don't think anybody would have pictured, you know, when Bill Giles kind of thought of this and led the search to have the Fanatic, you know, come to Philadelphia. I don't think anybody anticipated it would have the popularity and the longevity and the love, you know. And so I'm very proud, and I love seeing the Fanatic, you know, the headbands and the hats and people wearing their Fanatic gear. It's unbelievable. And then it's also just such a great way to bring new fans into the game and to make them Philly fans. And I have one story, and I've told it before, but it really, I always get goosebumps when I think about it. It was the last game at the Vet. It was the last year at the Vet, and it was the Fanatic birthday party, and Kevin Millwood threw a no-hitter. And I'll never forget coming back from the game, listening to sports radio, and everybody was calling because they were just at the game, and they were all saying, hey, we were at the game because it was the Philly Fanatic's birthday. We go every year, and now my kid got to see history made. And it's like, wow, well, there you go. And, you know, it could be the books. We just, you know, had our Fanatic about reading the other day, and a kid can be introduced to Phillies baseball through, you know, one of the kids' books, or maybe takes a doll to bed at night, and you know, he's it could be that. And so to know that the Fanatic plays a role in bringing, you know, cultivating sports fans and Phillies fans and baseball fans really is very satisfying.
Yeah, you know what? That is such an important part of it. The joy he brings each night is there, and we all enjoy that. But the long term effect, which I guess we can't really measure, but the long term effect is certainly there. My kids grew up with the Fanatic. I grew up with the Fanatic, and there's that's real. It's tangible. I wonder if it would have been this way in any other city in America. I've often wondered that. I mean, mascots come and go. There have been some good ones, there have been some bad ones, but nobody resonates like the Philly Fanatic. And I think part of that is because he's ours. And when we have someone that's ours, this city celebrates it like nobody else, right?
Yeah, for sure. It was a great mix. And it could have gone, I think, the other way if Dave Raymond wasn't who he was, or the costume didn't look the way it was. And so it could have maybe gone the other way. But yeah, once the Philly fans grabbed hold and made it there, very well said, Murph. It's true. It's the Fanatic's locked in now. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Bill Giles, Dave Raymond, Tom Burgoyne, you know, what they have been able to bring to us over the last, well, I don't even know, what is it, 35, 40 years?
Yes, 44 years.
44 years.
Yeah.
Just completely, it's just remarkable. Tom, thank you so much. I knew this would be fun. We could do this probably for another hour, but I won't
make it. Yeah, we could.
but thank you. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing you when we get back in town.
Yeah, safe travels, Murph. See you back at the ballpark.
All right, Tom Burgoyne joining us here on Glove Stories with Murph. Let's take a quick break, but up next, Charlie Manuel, Larry Boa join us here on the program. The all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app is here for both Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Get in on all the action, whether it's baseball, the basketball and hockey playoffs, golf, all your favorite sports. Download the all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app and make your first bet risk-free up to $750. Bet more than the score. Bet on individual player performances for hits, home runs, and strikeouts. Bet innings, first team to score, and more. BetParks is the only sportsbook and casino app that I recommend. The BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app, where odds, bets, slots, and games all come together in perfect harmony right in your pocket. Sportsbook and all your favorite casino games for real money, all in one amazing app. Live in-game betting lets you bet while you watch the game. Download right now in the App Store, Google Play Store, or at BetParks.com and use my promo code MURF. BetParks is also an official proud betting operator of the PGA Tour. The all-new BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app. You must be 21 and in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome to This Week in Philly Baseball History, presented by Scheib Vintage Sports. This week, in 1989, a 10-run Philadelphia comeback led Pittsburgh broadcaster Jim Rooker to embark on a 320-mile journey from the city of brotherly love to the Steel City. Vaughn Hayes and Steve Jeltz hit two home runs in a 15-11 victory at the Vet. Celebrate Philly sports history with a unique Father's Day gift from Scheib Vintage Sports. Visit them at 13th and Walnut Streets or scheibsports.com.
Phillies Nation is your source for breaking news, original analysis, trade insights, and more. Read today's articles at philliesnation.com.
And welcome back to Glove Stories, brought to you by the Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app, Scheib Vintage Sports, and Phillies Nation. And it is the time on the program where we welcome in our Phillies Wall of Famers. Larry Boa, Charlie Manuel are here. And this is going to be a fun topic, guys, because we're talking about, well, those guys that are on the other team that, well, you just can't stand, right? Fans always have a guy on the other squad that they don't like, but in a heartbeat would take them on their team because they are winners. They're good players. They're great players. They could be annoying gnat kind of players or just the kind of guy that just tears your heart out every single night. So guys that you played against that at the time, Larry, you didn't really like, but man, you would have loved them as a teammate.
Well, the one guy I hated him as not what I don't mean literally, but
yeah, when, I know.
When I saw that uniform, Pete Rose, he would do everything in his power to beat you. He could beat you with his glove. He could beat you with running the bases the right way, obviously swinging the bat. And eventually, the guy that we didn't like, he became a Philly. And when you're looking across the dugout and you see him, and you say, oh, God, he's coming up in the eighth inning. You know, this is the guy you don't want to see hit. But then to have him on our side, and those were the same ideas and everything that other teams, when he came became a Philly, they used to say, we used to hate Pete Rose. And everybody, guys, it seems like Murph that knew how to win, that would do anything at all to beat you. Those are the guys you really respect, but obviously you'd like them on your team. We were lucky to get Pete at the end, which put us over the hump, but I had to watch him in Cincinnati for a long time and he tore our hearts out. Believe me.
Yeah, I know. I, you know, you think back to that time period and as a fan, you know, that big red machine, it was like they couldn't do anything wrong. And Pete was the catalyst to all of that. So
unbelievable
standing in Philadelphia. Charlie, what about you in terms of guys that, that across the aisle, you didn't want to see them, but you love to see them in your uniform.
You know, like I used to see guys, what you're saying is I relate to the fact that you see guys. It's not like that I actually hated them or something, but I didn't want to see them come up and things like that. And so therefore I hated to see them come up the plate. And that was Barry Bonds, Ken Griffey Jr., guys like this. And there's guys that, who used to get real mad when they played, and you'd say, gee, Manny Christmas, what, you know, like, look at that guy's attitude or something. Paul O'Neill was kind of a, always kind of a, you know, like a high strung player, you know, he showed emotions. Even Ted Williams showed, you know, like, he, I think in Boston, that's why the press always talked about Ted Williams being so brass and so loud and stuff, you know, like, those kind of players, you know, like you kind of, although you might not like their attitude or something like that, or how they come across, you still like them because, and you admire them and you have respect for them for who they are. And when I see, you know, like somebody that's like had trouble in the game or something like that, but yet he still becomes a very famous player, you know, like that's who the guy is. That's his attitude. And I've seen guys that I didn't like, but at the same time, you know, like when I got around him, I liked him. Jason Worth was one of them. You
know that? Yeah, that's a good one. You know, yeah, I can totally see that.
Jason Worth, hey, look, when he played for the Dodgers, Murph, I can remember this just like, you know, like my first year managing, first year I saw him. And he didn't run balls out and stuff like that. And he was real kind of into himself and things like that. And I remember making a statement to Gary Varshow. I said, look, we could have that guy right there on our team. And, you know, like Pat Gillick went out and got him. That's a true story, I'm telling you.
You laid down the law pretty quick, I bet, right?
Yeah. You know what? I've always said this too. You know, like he changed when he wanted to play with our team, and also he respected our players, and his attitude completely changed. If you ask him, he would probably tell you the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Bo, let me ask you. So, most of the players we named, Hall of Fame caliber players, guys that are in the Hall of Fame or should be in the Hall of Fame. Right. What about maybe just that average guy that always seemed. Is there anyone you could think of in that?
Well, yeah, this guy wasn't average, but he's not a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Was Bill Madlock.
Okay. I mean,
this guy, he would come up with hits. He was a real good hitter. Yeah. And it seemed like he would always be hitting, whether he was with the Cubs or with the Pirates, always be hitting in crucial situations. You know, you expect the Stargills and the Clementes and that to get big hits.
Right.
But Bill Madlock was a grinder, man. And, you know, when he was on the same team as Bill Buckner, you got two guys on the corners there, outstanding players. Neither one of them made the Hall of Fame. And I'm going to tell you right now, Buckner, there might be some argument there. He had a tremendous career, but Bill Madlock was a Philly killer. And I used to hate watching this guy come up. He would never give away at bats. He was a tough out. And, you know, those guys, when they got in the batter's box, and Charlie can probably attest to this more than I can, you knew when they got in the batter's box, whoever was pitching, it was going to be a battle. I don't care how good your pitcher was that day. You had to do everything in your power to get these guys out, especially in crucial situations of the game, bases loaded or eighth inning, winning run on second, two outs. These guys always responded with big hits.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what we're talking about. Charlie. The kind of guy that he may end up striking out, but he sees 12 pitches and he's wearing out your guy, right?
Yeah. Starger was one of those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Willie Stargell was one of those guys. McCovey was one of those guys. I mean, you know, like I don't know if Bo probably saw McCovey more than I did. McCovey was definitely one of those guys.
Yeah, another great player.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
But then getting back to Paul O'Neill, he was one of those guys could hit too in big time. You know, like when he's up there, he was a tough out.
Yeah.
But most of that gets back. The guy's earned the right because he's a, you know, he's a very consistent player. You know, he's consistent in his hitting. You know, like, and he becomes a tough out because who he is and his makeup and you know, like, and how he grinds out. That's what a grinder is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what, Charlie, you had one of the ultimate grinders on your team, Chase Utley. You both know Chase really well. I mean, he was the guy. I mean, there was a time in his prime where every year you'd see the poll of Major League Baseball players, the most disliked player was Chase Utley. But again, there wasn't one team in the league that wouldn't have taken him in their clubhouse because that's the kind of player he was. And, you know, he happened to be here in Philadelphia, lucky for us, but that's the exact kind of player he was, right, Charlie?
He, without a doubt, that's exactly, you know, like he didn't talk much and he was hard to get him to laugh. But but at the same time, I'm going to tell you something. I loved him. Gay. Put a lot of money in my pocket.
You know, Murph, I think, you know, every team needs a player like that. Yeah. But if you're fortunate to have two of them, maybe three, it's unbelievable how it helps your clubhouse. Yeah. When you have everybody have the same personality, and not to say they're not good guys, they're all good guys, good players, but you need two or three guys that have that edge. And I think on this year's team, just watching, you know, I'm not down there in the uniform or anything, but Castellanos to me is that kind of guy. He plays with an edge. And when you get a guy like that, and he doesn't like to kibitz with other guys during the game, you see everything's all business in that. That's how you're supposed to play. And Ut did that as well as anybody. I like guys like that, and I think it brings something to your clubhouse. Obviously, the way people construct their teams now, they think maybe those guys are troublemakers. They're not troublemakers, believe me. They sort of put everything together and they're glued to your ball club. Absolutely. But that's when we played or coached, you needed those guys in that locker room.
Yeah. And they're few and far between nowadays. But if you do find one, you've got a thing for sure. Yeah. Charlie, Larry, great stuff as always. We certainly appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next week on Glove Stories, okay?
All right, Murph. Take care.
Welcome to This Week in Philly Baseball History, presented by Schaub Vintage Sports. This week, in 1989, a 10-run Philadelphia comeback led Pittsburgh broadcaster Jim Rooker to embark on a 320-mile journey from the city of brotherly love to the Steel City. Vaughn Hayes and Steve Jeltz hit two home runs in a 15-11 victory at the Vet. Celebrate Philly sports history with a unique Father's Day gift from Schaub Vintage Sports. Visit them at 13th and Walnut Streets or schaubsports.com.
The all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app is here for both Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Get in on all the action, whether it's baseball, the basketball and hockey playoffs, golf, all your favorite sports. Download the all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app and make your first bet risk-free up to $750. Bet more than the score. Bet on individual player performances for hits, home runs, and strikeouts. Bet innings, first team to score, and more. BetParks is the only sportsbook and casino app that I recommend. The BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app, where odds, bets, slots, and games all come together in perfect harmony right in your pocket. Sportsbook and all your favorite casino games for real money, all in one amazing app. Live in-game betting lets you bet while you watch the game. Download right now in the App Store, Google Play Store, or at BetParks.com and use my promo code MURF. BetParks is also an official proud betting operator of the PGA Tour. The all-new BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app. You must be 21 and in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Phillies Nation is your source for breaking news, original analysis, trade insights, and more. Read today's articles at PhilliesNation.com. Glove Stories with Murph is sponsored by the BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app, along with Shine Vintage Sports and Phillies Nation, and is a presentation of SBC Media Partners. The engineer for Glove Stories is Chad Evans. Cindy Webster is our marketing and guest relations director, and our executive producer is Roger Haddon. Whether you are watching us on YouTube or downloading the podcast from one of the major podcast providers like Apple, Google, or Spotify, make sure to hit like and subscribe.